are, if you're in your lesson book, we're on page 29, but I want to, because Scott did such a good job covering through chapter 21, I kind of didn't want to just go, and now we're in 24, so let's kind of get a running start into that, if that makes sense. Hopefully it does. So we'll cover some of 22, because we didn't really, last Wednesday, cover much of that, and there wasn't much left in the lesson about 22, so we'll do that, and 23 just kind of quickly before we get into the next lesson on in Caesarea. Here's just an outline of where I'm thinking we'll be for the rest of the quarter, Sunday and Wednesday. This is different from what's in your book by a week, so we're a week later. It's just gotten pushed back because we've had some good discussion. And so I figure it'll take us three classes to do in Caesarea. We'll outline the chapters and all that stuff tonight, and then next week, Sunday and Wednesday, we'll go through those good doctrinal lessons that are in there, and then go a little bit faster through that. And we still have got a flex week in there. If we happen to go long on something, that's okay. We're not going to rush. We'll flex to that last week if we need to. But as it stands now, we should finish by Sunday the 26th, but at least Wednesday. I don't want to start a new class on Wednesday, so I suggested we can have a singing or learn new songs. There were some sort of folks that mentioned wanting to learn some new songs. Okay, well, instead of starting the next quarter on Wednesday, we can start Sunday. But that's in limbo. We can do whatever we like on that. And make that kind of work for us. So, anyway, that's the lessons, and that's kind of where we are at in regards to status here in this last third of the quarter. All right, we're going to look at chapter 21. Before we do that, let's bow together and have a word of prayer. The righteous Father in heaven, we're thankful, Father, for the day that you bless us with, for the life that we have, for the joy that we have in Christ, the reason that we live, Father, in serving you. We're so thankful that you love us, and that you provide for us and care for us. We're especially thankful for your word to guide us as we study together this evening, that we glean the truths revealed in it and become better servants of yours and follow them through our lives, that we may seek to be found doers of your will and your word, Father. I ask you to be with us. We have those of our number who are sick, and those of our number who are in need of encouragement. May we help one another and serve one another as best that we can, Father. Continue to watch over us and bless us in Jesus' name. All right, chapter 21 is where I said we were. There was a question. I do watch the class, by the way, so that's fine. So I wanted to clarify that I was not off my rocker a little bit on question 11A, because it's written confusingly. So if you want to look back in your lesson sheet a couple pages, and hopefully this will clear up what I was trying to say in my question. I don't know if that's a run-on sentence that I wrote or if it makes sense or not. So first, let me say, I'm not trying to say in the question that Paul is trying to keep the law. And I think that's where I was off a little bit. And whenever I teach this again in another 10 years or something, then we will be sure that I fix this question. All right. So chapter 21, let's read this section beginning in verse 20. It says, When they heard it, they began glorifying God. And they said to him, "You see, brother, how many thousands there are among the Jews of those who have believed, and they are zealous for the law, and they have been told about you, that you are teaching all the Jews who are among the Gentiles to forsake Moses, telling them not to circumcise their children, nor to walk according to the customs. What then is to be done? They will certainly hear that you have come. Therefore, do this that we tell you. We have four men who are under a vow. Take them, purify yourself along with them, and pay their expenses so that they may shave their heads. And we will know that there is nothing to the things which have been told about you, but that you yourself also walk orderly, keeping the law." What they're trying to do, if I understand what's happening, is here are the elders in Jerusalem. We clarified all this with the Gentiles in Acts 15, but missing the point that the fact that the law is being fulfilled and doesn't have to be followed for the Gentiles would be applicable to Jews too. They're trying to make Paul keep the law, or show that he's keeping the law. It's not that he is, but they are trying to make him do that. And so, the question they ask in verse 22, what then is to be done? It's kind of like saying, what are we going to do about it? Here's what we've heard. In verse 21, we hear that you're telling the Jews and the Gentiles to forsake Moses, and you don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to walk according to the custom. So we're real worried about that. What are we going to do? Here's what we say that you need to do in verse 23 and 24, and so they acknowledge the truth of the matter that we learned in Acts 15 in verse 25, and then Paul goes and does this. So to clarify the question that I asked, so when I say how does the fact that Paul's confrontation with the Judaizers in Acts 15 and Galatians 2, and that he's already written Romans, probably Galatians, bear on the events of this section, which were designed to show that he walked orderly or keeping the law. What I mean by that is, how does it have an impact, what he wrote before, on the fact that they're trying to make him follow the law, or they're trying to make him show as if he's following the law? And so that point that I listened to the comments, they were great and on topic. It was my wording of the question that's off just a little bit. So what I was wanting us to get to is this truth that, like in Acts 15 and Galatians 2, Paul didn't have a problem telling people, he didn't have a problem telling the Gentiles, you don't need to be circumcised. He never taught it. And he wouldn't have a problem confronting Jews. He confronted Peter in his wrong attitude in Galatians as well. So I don't think, and I don't see Paul here yielding to, oh, well, I've been teaching that, now I've got to go keep the law. I don't see that. So him doing this in verse 26 and following, or really verse 26, so him doing this must not be in line with keeping the law as a sense of redemption, as a sense of I have to keep the law in order to be saved. It must be something different than that. And so that's what I suggested in some of my notes personally about perhaps he was keeping a custom. That's kind of the reason of question B there, you know, becoming all things to all men, to the Jews, that he might gain the Jews and all those sort of things. So it's not a matter of he's trying to keep the law in order to maintain his Jewishness, but it's, I can do this because it's not in violation of what God expects for me to do today, and it's not a requisite of what I have to do today, but it cleans, if you will, or allows me an opportunity to talk to the Jews about the issues at hand. So hopefully that clarifies that just a little bit. If not, that's, tell me later, and I've got to rewrite that question anyway, because it's a little hairy as to how it's put in there, but hopefully that helps a little bit. In chapter 22, let's move on to that and look at some of what happens in chapter 22.
I still don't understand, though, why they would ask him to do this. It makes no sense to me.
It makes no sense to me either why they would, if they truly understood what Acts 15 was all about, why would you not extrapolate that out? The same argument, and I've put this scripture in my notes, and this, it's okay, we can delay just a little bit in this, because you're fine, I shouldn't have said that. Acts chapter 2 and verse 39, here's Peter, and he says, for the promise, this is after our famous verse 38, where he says, for the promise is for you, your children, and for all those who are far off, as many as the Lord himself called to himself. All those who are far off, that's, look at all these others. It's going to be for everybody. That's what he's saying. But then he has issue and has to be taught correctly when you get to Acts chapter 10 about going and teaching Cornelius. So it's kind of one of those, did Peter really understand all or the totality of what he was saying there? Did the elders from Jerusalem understand the totality of everything that was decided and understood in Acts chapter 15? It appears, at least, that they had issue with that. But whatever it was, as far as why they had this issue, it must not have been too big of a deal, because why would Paul then go and do it and have a part in it?
Back in Acts chapter 15, the statement is made, then why do you test God by putting a yoke on the neck of the disciples with either... Yeah. Our fathers, nor we, are able to bear. So they're making the observation, we can't do this.
Yeah.
We are unable to keep the law perfectly. And so we're all lawbreakers. So why would there be any desire to try to keep any of this? It just doesn't make very much sense to me.
I agree. I don't know. Is for sure on that.
And then Peter's sorry. The one that says that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, in part, all our lives. It's a good commentary on the Bible and the Bible itself.
Right.
And in this context, what's the question in question? They're asking him of whether or not he's teaching Jews if they don't have to be circumcised. That's the context.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they have heard that he was teaching.
Yeah.
And it probably was.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, verse 24, they says, and be purified with them.
Mm-hmm. You need to fix the problem.
So they had a big issue.
Yeah. I think that's an extenuation of verse 22.
Something outside of this. This goes directly what they thought he was preaching.
Mm-hmm.
In my opinion.
Yeah.
Way out of where that comes from.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all related back to that issue of what we've been told about you. They don't ask him whether or not that's true. At least Luke doesn't record whether or not they don't come to him and say, "We heard that you were teaching this. Tell us that's not true," or something like that. It's, "What are we going to do about it? Here's what we'll do." And so we got to fix this problem, because if that's what you've been teaching, we got to solve this. And that was their answer. Yeah.
Paul's an apostle. He doesn't need to bend to their will.
Mm-mm. Yeah, he does not. And that's it's a great study in matters of indifference. That I think it doesn't matter to Hill of Beans here. He must be doing this out of a custom. I shared this thought with someone about it, that think of 1 Corinthians chapter 11 and head covering and our take on head. I think, nope, we're all pretty well in agreement on head coverings as being a custom. Otherwise, we would have participation in that. And so that's a custom. And Paul's conclusion of that is, I don't teach anything about it as to whether it's right or wrong. So if you want to cover, cover. If you don't want to cover, don't cover. It's not relying upon that. But in the custom of the day, it would be shameful if you didn't. And so there's that association with custom. And I don't know if this is the same, but I think there are some similarities in it.
Just one more quick point. When Paul meets here, at least it doesn't seem to me that the other apostles are there. Because when it first mentions it, it says on the following day that Paul went in with James and all the elders were present.
Yeah. Paul doesn't mention them, and they certainly had a charge to be going. I don't know whether how much they did or didn't. So.
Talking about the custom, you know good and well that the Jewish women, well, the men would have demanded it. The day after they were baptized into Christ, they didn't stop circumcising.
Right. Clearly. Yeah. Why have issue with it if you did? Yeah.
I mean, that was a, you call it a custom or a command here. But either way, they didn't stop overnight.
Mm-mm. Yeah. If it is a command, then the Gentiles would need to keep it. If you're doing it for salvation. And I think that's at the root of it is understanding when something is done for salvation or done to be pleasing to God. You had to keep the law to be pleasing to God, not just circumcision. That predates the law of Moses, but you needed to keep all of the law to be pleasing to God. And now you don't have to keep the law to be pleasing to God. And so where does that switch change amongst them, to where now they understand, well, Christ's fulfillment, I don't need to go make my sacrifices. I don't need to go on the Day of Atonement to make my sacrifices. And I don't need to, you know, calculate out 10% of all my spices and all that sort of stuff. I don't have to keep that law in entirety like I did before. There is a transitional period. So it's so important, like Acts chapter 2 and verse 42. Here's the apostles teaching. We're teaching them through that. And this kind of shows those growing pains with it as well. Scott?
One part of it is just similar to what Paul said. He had lived in good conscience before God all of his life.
Yeah.
I think this would have violated most of their consciences if they had quit doing all the things that they've grown up doing, and it would have been detrimental to them to stop, even though it wasn't required, but it would have made them feel guilty and like they were doing something wrong not to do it. Now, again, there are people that understood, hey, you don't have to keep doing this.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of people that did not understand that, I don't think, and they needed to keep doing it for their own good feeling and self-conscious.
Yeah, conscience. The issue of sacrificing those beasts to idols, like 1 Corinthians chapter 10, is you have the those that come out of that pagan religion that this meat was sacrificed to idols. How can you go buy it and eat it? And it was an attitude of not, or a problem, not attitude of, they didn't know. So once they learned to that point and they became mature enough, then they had to kind of let that go a little bit. So there was a matter of learning and more knowledge and growing in maturity in what they knew to be true. So those are all good points of discussion. I think there is an issue of conscience. I think there is an issue of custom here. Whatever it is, I want to make the point that it's not him keeping the law for salvation, because he's clearly taught against that before. And I don't believe, I mean, chapter 23 and verse 1 is the verse that Scott just mentioned. I've lived in perfectly good conscience for God to this day. If he's been teaching that you don't have to keep the law to be saved, I don't think that he's practicing the law here to be saved either. So, all right, chapter 22, you've got Paul's address in verses 22, verse 1 through 21. And I just want us to get the points of this sermon that he presents, or this speech that he gives. So as you read through chapter 22 and you go through these first 21 verses, first off, who is Paul talking to? Okay, so he's at the barracks and he's talking to the Jews. And what's the point of his address? Why talk about it? Okay, I think that's inclusive of it. He's explaining who he is. That should have an impact on the Jews that are listening. So he talks, he starts with his Jewish background. He talks, and the first thing he mentions is, I'm a Jew. I've been zealous for God. And look at the way he says this at the end of verse 3, just as you all are today. He says, we're the same. You're zealous for God, I'm zealous for God. That's where he starts off. Okay, where does he go from there in verse 4? He say, here's how zealous I was. What did I do? I persecuted them. New American Standard capitalizes the way. I think New King James does not, but that it neither here nor there. It's what he's talking about. The
New
way.
King James does.
The old King James does, or New King James?
The New King James does.
Okay, so it was the old King James that doesn't. I was looking at that today of interest, when they do or they don't.
That phrase is used multiple times in that.
Yeah, through this section, because he's going to be accused, and they use the way as that way he's accused about it. So I persecuted them. You can see how zealous I was to be doing all this. You're zealous. You're trying to get after me. I was zealous. We're all kind of doing the same thing. And who can verify that in verse 5? Yeah, the council, the high priest, everybody knows. Oh, goodness, they gave me the letters to go and arrest folks and to bring them back. Y'all are mad at me. You're trying to hurt me, and you're trying to kill me. That's what their intent is, the ultimate intent. And, hey, I'm a Jew. I'm the Jew of Jews. Hebrews, Hebrews. I'm a Pharisee. I am strict according to the law. I'm zealous. So he goes through his Jewish background. But something changed in his life. What changed in verse 6 through 10? What's the first thing that he says happened? I was on the road, and what did I see? Heard a bright light, and I heard the voice. Okay? Is he the only one that saw the light?
No.
Oh, there were others that were with him. He uses this phrase here. He says, be sure I've got the right one here. Verse 9, those who were with me saw the light, to be sure, but didn't understand the voice of the one who was speaking to me. So I said, it wasn't just me that saw the light. So there's some witnesses out there that can see this as well. And then what was he told to do? Twofold here. You're going to go to Damascus and you're going to wait. You're going to get further instruction. You're going to be told what to do. And it's twofold what he's going to be told to do. So based upon the, I was Jew of Jews. Here I was with you. This event happened. I followed the instructions that I got. And so then that next section deals with his conversion in verse 11 through 16. What's the first thing that happens? Lost his sight. He gets his sight back by verse 13. So there's this, his sight's restored. And then what does Ananias give him instructions about? Two things.
God chose him.
Mm-hmm. And something specific you're going to do. And then?
Arise and wash.
Arise and wash. All right, you need to be baptized. So he gives him instructions for what he's going to do for the Lord. Gives him instructions for salvation. So Paul is just outlining his life. How did we get to this point? Y'all know me. You know the kind of Jew I was. And to just turn a 180 doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Everybody's good listening to him up until this point, okay? Then in verse 17 through 21, we'll try to grab 3 points out of this section of the sermon. So he was coming to Jerusalem, and what did he? He got instructions. What was it?
They're not
going to
like you.
That's right. So he receives instructions, says, get out. You need to leave. Well, that doesn't make a whole lot of good sense to Paul, does it? So, what does he say? I told the Lord this in verse 19. I don't need to worry. Why do I need to worry? These people know me. They know what kind of person I was. They know what I was about in my zeal. So what did he used to do? He says, I imprisoned and beat those who believed in you. And when Stephen was being stoned to death, I stood there, watched the coats of the people that were doing it. And I was standing in approval for that. And so what instructions does the Lord give him in verse 21? You're going to the Gentiles, okay? So they were all good up to this point, right? Now, I mentioned this last week. This is culmination. So I don't want us to think we get to verse 21 and the Jews that were listening had perfect agreement with everything he had to say and were like, thumbs up, you're my kind of guy. They're not. This just is, I can listen to what you have to say until you get to that you're going to go tell Gentiles that they can be in a relationship with Jehovah, with Yahweh. So they are ready to kill him, and that's in verse 22 and the rest of the chapter there. Okay? Thoughts on through chapter 22 then? Kind of covered it. No, that was it. You think it's okay to... It wouldn't be okay for him to say, and I started serving Jesus, but to say not only that, I'm going to go take it to the Gentiles. Oh, we can't even eat with them. That's the issue that they had with Peter when he had gone to Cornelius and his household. Okay. All right. Chapter 23 then. We'll go through chapter 23 just quickly. We see that he's before the council, and so we get down. I'm skipping all the way down to verse 23 then, when Paul is sent to Caesarea. So what happens between verse 1 and verse 23? Give us the cliff notes then of Acts 23, 1 through 22 then. What's the gist of this?
Because the council's divided against themselves.
Yeah. The council's divided against themselves based upon...
I'm here because of the resurrection of the dead.
That's right. That's going to set the Sadducees against the Pharisees. I got a question here. Verse 2, Ananias is the high priest, and he tells those people standing by Paul, strike him on the mouth. Okay, was that legal?
No.
Not according to the law. That's what Paul appeals to. So it's a pretty bold statement then in verse 3. God's going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit to try me according to the law, and in violation of the law, order me to be struck. Is that violation of the law? The law of Moses allow you to hit somebody before they've been judged? strike them, scourge them? Pretty easy to figure out. No.
Paul was pretty versed in the law.
He was. You probably got Leviticus 19:15, Deuteronomy 25:2 there in a reference to that. Both of those are good verses to go into show that. I'll just quickly have us look at Deuteronomy chapter 25 and verses 1 and 2. Deuteronomy 25, verse 1 and 2 says, if there's a dispute between men and they go to court, the judge decides their case, they justify the righteous and condemn the wicked, then it shall be, if the wicked man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall make him lie down and be beaten in his presence with the number of stripes according to his guilt. That's just one explanation of one example that you've got to justify that this is right in doing that. Okay? You then have this arrest that happens. He's going to be sent to Caesarea beginning in verse 23. So, verse 23, who is the leader of, or the centurion, the commander? We'll find out his name later.
Lysias?
Yeah, Claudius Lysias or Lysias, however you want to say his name. He writes a letter, and he's going to outline what happens. So, verse 26, Claudius Lysias to the most excellent governor, Felix. Greetings. Okay. When this man was arrested by the Jews and was about to be slain by them, I came up to them with the troops and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman. Wanting to ascertain the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to their council. I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. When I was informed that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, also instructing his accusers to bring charges against him before you. Does he write the truth in that letter? Complete truth? Is that true? That is exactly what happened.
It's a
little gray. Makes him look good. What part of it makes him look good?
Rescued him because he found out he was broken.
That's right. That ain't exactly how it played out, is it?
I was about to beat him, and I said, oh, I better not do this.
Yeah, I have stretched out ready to beat him. And then he said he was a Roman, and, oh, well, I better stop. So why would he write it that way? Keep himself out of trouble. Not okay to beat a Roman if he hasn't been judged according to the law, according to Roman law. Something else is interesting. In verse 9, he says, I found him, verse 29, excuse me, I found him to be accused over questions about their law, but under no accusation deserving death or imprisonment. If he's innocent, what should Lysias have done?
He shouldn't be writing the letter. It should already been taken care of.
We should be finished with this problem. Okay. As we go through this next section through Caesarea, that's the same conclusion that's going to be brought about when Agrippa, when he makes his appeal before Agrippa. And like verse 32 of chapter 26, this man might have been set free if he'd not appealed to Caesar. So he's innocent. They keep going through this, verse 31. This man's not worthy of anything, has not done anything worthy of death or imprisonment. He hadn't done anything worthy of what he's dealing with, and yet nobody sets him free. He's appealed to Caesar, so we're going to send him on then to Caesar. All right, that gets us through chapter 23 just quickly. Anything before we move on? Good deal. Let's move quickly then through this next section in Caesarea. And you should hopefully have page 29 already, some of this filled out. So we're going to section this up. Hopefully, as you read through, you may have made a few notes here or you got some headlines. So in chapter 23, this begins in verse 31 through 35. What is that section about? And don't say it's about five verses, because that's correct, but not what I'm looking for. He's brought to Caesarea. That's what that's about. Okay. Chapter 24, 1 through 21. Okay, so now we're making it a little bit more official. So there's an attorney, Tertullus, and he's going to bring the charges against Paul before Felix. Okay, verses 22 through 27, through the end of the chapter. What's that about?
Paul
How long? Verse 27.
2 years.
2 years. 2 years. Just so that it matches what I've got on the screen, but you're fine. Yeah, Paul's kept in custody by Felix for 2 years. It almost seems as if he's forgotten for a greater part of that. Okay, chapter 25, verses 1 through 12. All right, before Festus, and the conclusion of it is,
are you willing to be judged by these people?
And he says,
no,
negative.
Are you willing to be judged by Caesar?
That's right. So in this trial before Festus, that's the result of the trial, as he appeals to Caesar. You don't have to match up with mine. Verses 13 through 27 of chapter 25. Agrippa, Bernice, and Festus, great names during the time. It sounds like Beverly Hillbillies almost. Festus and Agrippa and Bernice. Okay, so those three, that's just kind of that section there. Chapter 26, 1 through 11.
Paul starts to recount his story again.
Okay, so he begins to recount that, and that goes through, we'll cover it through verse 32, and this is all to Agrippa where he does that. And there's that famous verse that I've preached on before in verse 28. In a short time, you'll persuade me to become a Christian. And so what he means by a short time, we'll see during that. All right, so question number two, I ask you to write a brief phrase identifying the following people. So let's identify these folks. Who is Tertullus? An orator. What's an orator? Speaker. Orator. So he's presenting the case. He's an attorney. He's the prosecution, if you will. We're setting up the case here, okay? Who's Felix?
The first
governor. Governor. Yeah, he's the governor of Judea, procurator. Who is Drusilla? That's Felix's wife. We've got some information about her. McGarvey gives some more information about her, that they're in an adulterous relationship. So it's Felix's adulterous wife, and she's the daughter of Herod Agrippa. And so McGarvey, and how he comes to these conclusions, we can go look at that amongst us. But it says she's probably about 20 years old at this time.
So Agrippa, even though he was the king,
mm-hmm.
Wasn't he kind of like a...
Well, he's appointed by the Romans. Romans allow him to be in power, so I don't know past that if he is or isn't. I've got that he is, let's see, based upon, like I use McGarvey for this, he is the great, he is the son of Herod Agrippa the First, and great-grandfather was Herod the Great. So I'm not sure. I'll have to look back at some of that sort of stuff. I didn't get much...
The Herods were Jewish ruling family, but I don't know how Jewish they really were.
I don't know. I have to look at it and see. Hopefully before Sunday I'll have that figured out. Let's see. Ananias. Who's Ananias? Chapter 24 and verse 1, Ananias.
High priest.
He would have, according to Smith's Bible Dictionary, he was disposed shortly before Felix left the province. And he was nominated to the office by Herod in about AD 48. Okay, so you can look up that and see if it's all true. Just sharing that info. Porcius Festus. Who's Festus?
Another governor,
successor of Felix. So he's after Felix. That, and we get some time stamps just in societal history. So that's about 59 to 60. Who's Caesar? Roman Emperor. Okay, you know, we're really going to test your Bible knowledge and your historical knowledge. Who would Caesar have been during about this time? So there's one that reigned from about 54 to 68 A.D. Good guess. These are all Caesars. It would be Nero. You've heard about Nero. It's during his time frame. We feel real confident that is the... Caesar at the time. All right, we've already mentioned Agrippa. He's Drusilla's brother, so this is all sort of a weird familial relationship. And who's Bernice? Yeah, there's Drusilla's sister, Agrippa's, the second sister. So you probably would have to look up some of this sort of stuff on some outside resource. You're not going to get all this stuff just there. So kind of gives us an idea of all the characters that we've got now in this section. So quite a bit that happens.
Savory bunch.
It is. I'm telling you, he's in good hands while he's on trial here. What's that? It is a motley crew. For sure. All right. So, Paul is in Caesarea. We've already answered this question. It's question number three. How long was he in Caesarea?
2 years
and many days. So, I put 2 years plus. So, you've got verse 27 of chapter 24. After 2 years passed, and then Felix had was succeeded by Festus. There. Okay? We'll answer some of these questions as we can here instead of getting into the meat of that chapter. So let's go ahead and answer a few more. What three chapters in Acts record Paul's conversion? 9, 22, 26. So he's going to recount it again in chapter 26. So if I want to get the full picture of what happened, or a fuller picture of what happened, I can go take the information from 9, and there's a little bit more information in 22, and there's a little bit more information in 26, and I can bring all those three accounts together and get that together. And if you, we did that 3.5 years ago when we studied Acts 1 through 12, so you should have some of that. Okay, question 5, which rulers did Paul stand before in Caesarea, and what was their office? So, two-part question here. So, which did he stand before? In chapter 24, who was he standing before? Felix, and Felix was what office? He was governor, okay. In chapter 25, who did he stand before?
Festus
was governor. And chapter 26, Agrippa, and Agrippa has this title of king. So those are the ones that he is before giving his defense and being tried against.
Or back in 26, that's who he was. 26 verse 2, I think it's that Matthew Paul, King of Israel, that's all the things that he's especially because you are expert in all customs and questions which have to do with you. So whether or not he was, to me it doesn't sound like he was a Jew at all, but he knew.
He knew their,
spent some time studying their history.
Yeah, I can agree with that. Makes good sense to me, the way that that's written, the way that Luke reports that. All right, let's look at this first accusation in, or this first trial that begins in chapter 24. And we've got all the folks identified, so we'll see Tertullus as the attorney, and he's going to bring the charges against Paul. So when he comes and he's presenting this to Felix, what are the accusations? What does he say Paul has done that's so bad he's worthy to die? It's the first one. He stirs up riots. It's not the first one of God. He's what? He's a real pest. We got to do something with this guy. He's a real pest. New King James Version said he's a plague. Okay? So it's things are not great. This guy is something else. He's causing trouble. He's a real pest. And then what does he do? He stirs up riots or dissension among all the Jews throughout the world. Not just in Jerusalem. Everywhere he goes, he stirs up the Jews. Is that true? Do the Jews get stirred up everywhere he goes? It's at least partially true, isn't it? They seem to get mad. Not all the Jews, not everywhere. It's kind of true, but not provable. It's the Jews that get upset. It's not him that's stirring them up in that. Okay, what else? It's the third thing. He desecrates the temple. That's the last one I've got. There's one before that one.
He's a ringleader of the Nazarenes.
He's a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Aren't you glad that we're called Christians and not Nazarenes? That sounds a whole lot better. Is he a ringleader? What is a ringleader?
Sounds like a leader of a gang.
That's what it sounds like, yeah. He's calling the shots. Okay, think of the circus, yeah. And so, hey, he's orchestrating all of this that's happening throughout the world. It's all Paul, and he's been doing it. Is he a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes? Outside looking in, does it look like it?
Yes.
Looks like it. Is he calling all the shots? No. And Paul's point is you can't prove any of this stuff that they're saying. That last one was already mentioned. Tried to desecrate the temple. Did he try to desecrate the temple? How did they say he desecrated the temple, though? You brought Gentiles in. That would desecrate the temple. So here's the accusations that he is, you know, facing. Are they true?
Some of them have a ring of truth to them, but they're not true.
Yeah. Look at verse 14. This is the closest that I can say. So I put no, they're not true, but there is something about the sect in verse 14 that I want to make mention of. So let's kind of get all of this going. And let's back up to verse 10, and then we'll make mention of 14 when we get to it. It says, knowing that for many years you've been a judge to this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. So, you know, you got to butter them up a little bit before you say what you got to say. I'm so happy to make my defense before you. Since you can take note of the fact that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. There's a time stamp if you're marking them, by the way. Neither in the temple, nor in the synagogues, nor in the city itself did they find me carrying on a discussion with anyone or causing a riot. So he just knocked out several of them. You can't say that I am stirring up dissension. I didn't start a riot. I didn't get any of that going on. Nor can they prove to you the charges of which they now accuse me. And so everything they've had to say is without merit. But I'll admit something, he says. According to the way, so there's another mention of that, the way, probably capitalized in your translation, which they call a sect, I do serve the God of our fathers, believing everything that is in accordance with the law and that is written in the prophets. So what is he saying that the way is? Is it contrary to the law?
No, it's according to the law.
It's according to the law. They want to call it a sect. The Jews want to call it a sect. What's a sect, by the way? Separate group. Yeah. So there's a big group. And then there's this outlier over here, and they're a sect. And so they're different than we are. And he says, that's not the case. I serve the God of our fathers. If you've got a literal sort of note there on verse 14, you've been the ancestral God. The God of our ancestors. I've been serving God, Jehovah. That's who he's mentioning. I serve him, and I believe everything that's in the law and everything that's in the prophets. So he is going to appeal to the fact that Jesus is fulfillment of the law and Jesus is fulfillment of the prophets. And so that's a good place for us to stop there. That's question 6. And we'll pick up with 7 and following through on Sunday. So let's stop there and we'll go through and talk a little bit more about this on Sunday. And be sure and answer the questions before then, and we'll go over them Sunday. Thank you.